Hi, I'm Alex Beam. I'm a living arts columnist for the Boston Globe, and this is my podcast of reader hate mail. People legitimately might ask, well, why not have all the mail, have the occasional letter praising my work? But how interesting would that be? More buffery, as people say. I once did a column in which I quoted the rather astonishing Dominique de Villepin, who is the Prime Minister of France. And de Villepin was quoted as saying that praise is inevitably useless and of no value, and only criticism can be used as a tool for learning. This was related to a very strange incident where he sought out France's greatest failures. He became obsessed with the men and women who had failed most in France because he felt he could learn the most from them. Well, in any case, I don't think the men and women who send me these fantastic letters are failures. In fact, I think they're successes, and that's why we're putting their letters on the air right now. So these letters relate to a column I published on March 12th called Wikipedia and Me, in which I alternately flattered myself for having a fairly detailed Wikipedia entry and then whined up the joint because I felt it was inaccurate. And I was most wounded, I felt, by the entries in Wikipedia that described me as an anti-Canadian polemicist. The fact is that I'm one of the biggest lapdogs for Canada. I actually counted, I've written 14 columns about Canada. I'm their faithful servant here beneath the 49th parallel, and yet the hostile mail came in. Here's a letter from Howard Cox.
I'd just like to say, why didn't you correct the errors? Why do all these people complaining that there are errors and problems with Wikipedia not help to correct them? People somehow have a problem with that fact that on Wikipedia, anyone can edit. They see it as a disadvantage that anyone can write anything they like. What they never say or do is fix the problem themselves. It's not that hard, Alex.
Howard, thank you. I actually did go through the correct procedures with Wikipedia. There's a clicking link saying, if this entry is about you, click here. And I got absolutely no satisfaction within a reasonable time limit. So as I wrote in the column, I actually ended up phoning the second most powerful man on the internet, Lawrence Lessig, the Stanford law professor, who has this incredibly helpful and smart assistant who cleared up everything for me. I then got a bunch of emails saying, give us the phone number of Lessig's assistant. But I'm keeping it extremely closely held. Now, here's another reader who had a problem with that same Wikipedia column, Joe Kelly.
I read your column in Today's Globe and was fascinated by the word buffery. Since I couldn't find it in any dictionary, I wondered if you meant puffery.
Joe, thanks for your letter. We don't need no stinking dictionaries here at the Boston Globe. We make up our own words. So I made up the word buffery. In fact, I put a CQ next to it when I sent it to the desk, which means, desk, keep your gosh darn cotton-picking hands off my neologism. Now, finally, in this column about Wikipedia, I got a third letter complaining from a lady in Canada.
Well, yes, Alex, to be sure. But what about that little item some time ago about Canadian prostitutes being on board a steamer that goes to and fro New England? Didn't sound very pro-Canadian. It was also unfair, as my writer friend Garfield McVicker wrote you some weeks after that column.
Thank you, Carol Bradford, who signs her letter in parenthesis, still a friend. Carol's been reading since the Pleistocene era, it would seem. Because years and years ago, I wrote a parody, actually, of a Walt Whitman poem in which I referred to the prostitute-infested ferry that plies the waters between Portland, Maine, and Yarmouth, Nova Scotia. I actually once saw one prostitute on board this Swedish-operated ferry. It's called the Scotia Prince. It's now out of service, unfortunately. And indeed, possibly the most famous columnist in New Brunswick, Canada, Garfield McVicker, excoriated me in his column. And from St. John's all the way to St. Stephen's, I think, my name was complete mud. So good memory, Carol. Maybe once or twice I've poked fun at Canadians, but my heart is with the Maple Leaf forever. Baby. These next letters relate to a column that I published on March 14th, and it was about a new advertising campaign put forward by New York City. It was actually aimed at Europeans. It was splashed all over billboards, primarily in London and Dublin, anywhere where the euro is incredibly strong and where they speak the lingua franca of New York City, which astonishingly is still English. In any case, I happened to be in New York City when I wrote this column. I was looking for an excuse to do something about New York. And not surprisingly, the seven major points behind this advertising campaign were all totally false, either about 15 years out of date or relied on statistics that were erroneous or had been twisted totally out of recognition. I mean, the most humorous one, of course, was where New York City claimed to be the safest city in all of the United States. It's not even remotely close to true, A. And B, the hilarious thing is that when I was in New York, the biggest tabloid story of all was of some thug who had beaten up an 88-year-old grandmother in an elevator somewhere in Queens. And there was an all-points bulletin, sort of dragnet style, all over the city to find this granny basher. And, of course, they never found him. He just became yet another part of those unbelievably low New York crime statistics. In any case, the New Yorker files, of course, somehow found this column and responded with vehemence and at some length. Here's Catherine Doyle writing in from Cambridge, Massachusetts.
Dear Alex, after growing up in New York City and having lived there for 34 years, my family and I moved to Cambridge. It is astounding to me the ingrained contempt and hatred this city feels for New York. I'll never forget the first time my three young girls were watching Yankee Polly O'Neill warm up for a game at Fenway, and some little boy just a few feet away yelled, "Polly, you suck!" I immediately looked toward the dad, thinking he would reprimand his son for the language and disrespect, and instead he patted the boy on the back and said, "You tell him, son." Alex, you might try bringing some positive journalism to us. Just think, you could be credited with being the first person to write truthful and positive reasons as to why Boston, deep down, loves New York, but they won't admit it because they might disappoint their parents.
Yeah, that's one of 18,000 columns. I don't think I'll be writing Catherine Doyle, but thank you for your thoughts. I mean, the only interesting thing about Paulie O'Neill, of course, is that he's the brother of Molly O'Neill, the famous food writer for the New York Times and others. And regrettably, Catherine, Paul O'Neill does suck. Now, here's another similar letter I received from Howie Beardsley.
Really now, Alex, does Big Brother down south in the Big Apple really unnerve you to this degree? Where's the competition? Of course the Yankees suck. Just read the bumper sticker on the car in front of you. I think the New York ad agency just used the poetic license pen, which apparently you misplaced after writing one of your recent columns.
Hey, thanks, Howie. Thanks for the thoughts. Actually, I still have that poetic license pen, as you call it, and I'll be using it quite a bit in the future. Here's another letter I got. This man, Alan Brown, from faraway Pattaya, Thailand, read my column in the International Herald Tribune.
Alex, 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 your inferiority complex is showing. Don't feel bad about being from Boston. Your city is a very nice little city. Instead of trying to tear down what is perhaps the greatest city in the world, why don't you stick to building up your own city instead?
Point taken, Alan, and thank you for the letter. On March 21st, I published a column written under the nom de plume of Mr. Fassi, which is an identity I've taken on probably for about 10 years. About two or three times a year, I'll adopt this persona, which I stole from a very successful children's book character created by Roger Hargreaves, who's deceased. And actually, I've consulted numerous patent and trademark attorneys who assure me that my theft of Mr. Fussy is completely above board. In any case, in this particular column, Mr. Fussy was musing at some length about sleep and napping, which are two subjects that he considers to be extremely important. The ostensible peg was that the Ministry of Health in France had just issued a report urging French people to take more naps, as had Harvard School of Public Health. And since Mr. Fassi takes a lot of naps, he was all for this. At the same time, Forbes magazine, Good Morning America, everyone was publishing these ridiculous stories averring that, quote, sleep is the new sex. And I ended the column with almost a really unfair attack on, I guess, the guy I considered the Wizard of Oz of sleep ridiculousness, a PhD professor up at the University of New Hampshire named Michael Mangan, who had cornered the market on what he alleged to be a significant psychological disorder. He called it sexsomnia. And you'll definitely want to go to his website called sleepsex.org. Mangan basically says that there's a lot of sexual assault that takes place while men and women are asleep. Now, this is not in their dreams, he would have us believe. He says that there's a lot of violent physical assault, possibly as many as one rape reported every 10 years. And I know that that statistic you'll find to be extremely disturbing. In any case, I ended this column in a not so nice way. I wrote about Mangan that, quote, you can rest assured that his medical credentials are sound. That's because he's been on Fox TV and the Keith Abelow show. I go on to write, while Mangan's website acknowledges that the American Academy of Sleep Medicine's diagnostic manual does not include SBS, which is his fancy name for sexsomnia or sleep rape, as a specific sleep disorder, it has been mentioned in Cosmopolitan, Red Book, and Details. I finished the column with this rather nasty line, Cosmopolitan, it's the new journal of the American Medical Association. Wake up and smell the idiocy. Now here's Mangan's letter.
Mr. Beam, as you ridicule, you become part of the problem surrounding sexual behavior in sleep. People are too embarrassed and ashamed to seek help, and when they do, they are met by incredulity by healthcare providers who are just as ignorant as you. Persons with undiagnosed sexual behavior in sleep are at risk of being accused of sexual assault. Left untreated, they risk exposing others to unwanted sexual contact. This is particularly tragic when minors are involved. It's a serious problem that should be taken seriously. My advice to you is this. Do your homework before you decide to perpetuate ignorance and bias. Consider the possible consequences of your actions before you publish columns that you might think are funny but may do harm.
Yes, there it is. The voice of academic reason and good judgment. It's that inner voice that I will literally never, ever listen to. Special thanks to Ann Silvio and Joe Kahn, who helped me do this podcast. And I hope you'll be back again for the next installment. And keep the hate mail coming.